My name's Jack Dempsey. I'm a drunk, not a fighter. How you doing today?
Hi, Jack.
Hello, Jack. Yeah, boy.
Lots and lots and lots. Oh,
I guess you probably like your old guy squirm on that, you know, listen to all that kind of stuff. I appreciate being asked to come up here. It's just, it's an honor, and it's some sort of special thing to have. I'm always surprised. I shouldn't be, because AA and Al-Anon's done it for my family, but I'm always surprised when my daughters and my grandkids and that include me in things. And when the young people in AA are just being AAs, are just being AAs and being friendly and loving and including, and it still surprised me, because there's like a thing that goes on between as you get older, I guess, and you get more reserved. I certainly enjoyed Joe and Clarence this morning. Joe was quoting Mark Twain, and I remember something Mark Twain said that I don't know whether I agree with or not, but yeah, he said that that there's only one thing worse than a young pessimist, and that's an old optimist. And I think only AA could turn that around, because Mark Twain was pretty sharp about stuff. You know, we sort of like demand everybody be an optimist here. God damn it. You know, just get with it. And that extra nudge, you know, that you get here seems to do the trick. I want to apologize for any swearing I do up here, and I was asked to swear here. I can't believe it. I talked to something that was the first. Somebody called me up and asked me to talk, and they said, I really liked your talking, but you swear too much. And they said, well, you swear an awful lot, and I, you know, we'd appreciate it, because we never had anybody ever demand more swearing. You know, they said, you know, geez, there was a real swearing deficiency in some of them talks. And so that, because that never happened, well, they said, so I got up there, and I couldn't believe it myself. Maybe with some help from a good taper, you could have some of it edited out, but I actually didn't swear, you know, a lot. Or I swear one or two words that everybody says, even on network TV. And I got so many compliments that from the person that chaired that meeting. They must have been taking a lot of heat from somebody else that talked to her. I don't know. But they kept writing me little postcards and sending me pictures of their home. And I guess they want to encourage me to live in a neighborhood or something, because I'm so mindful of my manners now, you know. But I wouldn't want to try so hard to not say anything vulgar or something, so that I would actually not be me, you know. I mean, if you knew me when I was drinking, you'd say he's pretty good, no matter what I say up here, you know. And my wife's here to testify to that, too. She come along with me, and she goes with me places when we can, and she seems to enjoy herself, and she certainly likes members of AA, and she's a good Al-Anon. She's like a, sort of a SWAT Al-Anon, you know. Al-Anon SEAL, maybe, huh? Now, you know, the funny thing is, like, God gets everybody for whatever they do, and there's a couple things I'm going to mention about my wife, you know. My wife has got a pigeon in Al-Anon. And her boy is a SEAL, a Navy SEAL. He's like a lieutenant commander or something. He's bad, you know. And so my wife is sponsoring his mother. And his mother is like the only one that has any control over that SEAL. You can't mess with SEALs. But Mom can say, now listen. You know, and he listens, which is a great thing. So through my wife, I got some kind of contact here with the SEALs, you know, as distorted as it is. So I thought, boy, that's a good thing to have in reserve in case somebody's mean to you or something, or, you know, sort of a bad dude. But the other thing that happened to her was she went through a period where people were calling her Mrs. D and Mrs. Jack and stuff. And she didn't like that. She's sort of like a liberated girl. And she sort of distanced herself from me in a lot of cases, because it was more dignified not to be a part of my, whatever I was doing, drunk or sober. You know, it just, people would just go, jeez, man, what's the matter with that guy? And they'd say, you're married to him, aren't you? You know, and she would like to have to plead the fifth or something. But she was always dealing with that. She didn't want to deal with that. And so she started saying she wanted her own identity. And just about the time she was going through a period of telling everybody her name was Janet, and if you didn't quite get it or you dismissed her, she would like grab you and spell it or something, you know. And just at that time, I talked someplace, and she talked also. but they got her name wrong. And it was the only place that ever had the names on. They give us like these little ceramic coffee pots, like a sort of token appreciation of coming down and all that. We like, and there, her name was said Helen on there. I couldn't believe it. And of all the times for that to happen while she was on this campaign, and I thought, boy, there's really my higher part is the one with a sense of humor. I don't know. And but that happened, and she was just stiff upper lip, and she just walked right through that and told them that's not my name. And so they this was nervous, and they got her flyers and everything. And the name of the place, I might mention, maybe somebody knows that group's at, it was Defiance, Ohio, you know. And she, all the way home in the car, she said, that's a good name for that place, you know. But they brought her flyers and tried to make do with that thing. But then the other regular AAs, they just couldn't help themselves. They come over to her and they said, well, that was what he called you the last time we seen it with her, you know. And, boy, it just never ends in here. You got to be ever vigilant, you know. But we're married a long time. We were married 38 years, and I drank 13 of them. And, boy, it was really a close shave for us to be still married. We've had friends tell us we got so many common enemies now, we might as well stick it out for the rest of the thing. And when I say enemies, I mean people like the utility companies and the bank and stuff like that, and neighbors that insist on me cutting trees down that I like a lot and things like that. But and we got the grandkids to torture both of us equally, and we torture my daughter by spoiling our grandkids and sending them back home as soon as possible, and then running off to things like these. And then when my daughter gets agitated, we accuse her of not going to enough Al-Anon meetings. So everything all works out. You can have a lot of fun sober. And, you know, I think that I'm here to tell you that story about me being an alcoholic. You know, I think that's the only thing I have to say, really. And my opinion of what an alcoholic is. Whether I swear or not, I don't think it matters, you know. I'm going to try not to so much. But I want to say this about that one thing before I go on ahead. Everybody, I think, has little things they like to hang on to, you know. And I can understand somebody hanging on to, I'm going to clean up this world and we'll have it. Nobody swear. Nobody smoke, don't swear, don't spit. And, boy, it'll get so good you won't be able to stand it. But then you got people that are fine-tuning this on the other end, like me, that are sitting around saying, well, okay, if nobody else swears, I won't swear. But no more of that goddamn leverage buyout bullshit, you know. No more closing mills down, throwing 400,000 men out of work so you can make an extra goddamn mutual fund bond or something. And so I get all excited too, you know. But I'm not up here to do that. See? When Rush Limbaugh gets sober and he gets up here, then we'll, you know, we'll go back and forth. But I think that everybody has a little bit of craziness in them, and Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where we can, like, share it and laugh at it, and we laugh at ourselves. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, man, screaming and fighting. I didn't want to come here. I tell you, I sat on a bar stool when I was 18 or 19 years old, drunk, and I reflected on what was the matter? What is the matter with everything? Why am I here drunk? Why is my car outside with four different sized tires on it? Windshield wipers broke on my side. The bumper's dangling down. She's mad at me. The phone's jumping off the wall in this bar. Is Jack there? Is Jack there? And I'm sick and I'm angry and my boss is mad at me and I can't get ahead and I don't have any money and I stink and my pants are ripped in the back and it's just bad. And I was half drunk and I come up with what was wrong. I just knew what was wrong. It just, as the whiskey went through me, the answers just come to me, and I knew. You know, I just knew it was wrong. What was wrong was I had a rotten home life. As opposed to everyone else in the world, they all had great home lives. And I just seemed to see all that stuff. I seen the mothers coming down when I was a kid and bringing pie down to their little boys, and the fathers coming out and ruffling their hair and sparring with them and say, hi, boy, Johnny, you're such a good boy. Yes, Daddy, you know. And me, I didn't have none of that. I had a working mother. She was never home. When she was home, she indulged me. She spoiled me, but she never was hard. She didn't seem to be there. My father is a professional bridegroom. He's married 5 times. He had 1 kid, me, and he quit that. You know? And I took it personal. I didn't like it. And I had a grandmother that raised me. God rest her soul. I loved her. I'm sure she loved me, but she was the damnedest individual you ever seen. She weighed about 300 pounds, and she used to get involved with my peers when I was just a little kid. I mean, she'd come out on the street where we were playing and come up in their faces and give opinions and things. And she weighed about 300 pounds, and she'd blow her nose on her apron and go back in the house. You know? And all them kids would laugh at my grandmother. Now, I hated my grandmother for embarrassing me, and I hated those kids for laughing at my grandmother. And I had a big, mess there. I had that conflict of interest, and I had all that mixed emotion, and I didn't even know what those things were. And I had them, and I was suffering with them. And I hated them kids, and I got a chip on my shoulder. And I got the worst thing I think can happen to an alcoholic. And I'm not sure every alcoholic has this problem. But that is self-consciousness. See, you can, if you have self-consciousness like me, you could pawn it off as being good. See, it's not like self-centeredness when everything's mine, me. You know, I mean, I felt like that, but I was self-conscious enough to know better than to do that. See, I knew everybody knew. As soon as I want some, oh, you do you? And I knew in advance that they would, if they didn't say it, they'd think it. They'd look at me like, yeah, you sure do. You sure do need something more to eat or drink or a wig. You know, I can see that, you know. And I would just be so full of me that I could do whatever I wanted to do. But the worst of it was that I felt that I had the responsibility to deal with everything that come down for me. When I was afraid, I felt legitimately afraid, but I thought, there's something I got to do about this. I remember getting self-conscious about my autonomic nervous system. You know, I'm just a little kid. I'm thinking, if I don't keep my mind on it, my heart's going to quit. I mean, that's a big thing it's doing in there, and you better keep an eye on it, you know. Well, you go to sleep at night, and they don't even give you prayers if I should die before I wake, you know. So you can put you to bed. Now think about that, Jackie. You know? And I thought all kinds of things. I thought bugs, people ain't going to hear things. Adults would say things. They would dismiss the kids, and you would hear them say things. Why, they got bit by a bee and died. Old Charlie did. You know, he swelled up, and he turned green, and he died. You know? Somebody else died from this. Cat scratched him. That was the end of him, you know? And I'm a little kid. I'm out in the world with all these things. There's cats out there. And I found everything the hard way. Everything. I found out why you shouldn't play with matches, by getting burnt and by catching a living room on fire and having my uncle throw a couch through a window to get it out of the house. And everybody and all the adults were running around being grateful that the house wasn't burnt down. And I was wondering why that displaced gratitude wasn't directed to saving my ass from everybody beating on it. But that didn't happen, see? And I got called all the things that I was very sensitive about. I got called stupid. I got called naughty and inconsiderate and self-centered and everything else. So I discovered what matches will do. And I went on and on to remake some of the similar mistakes. I remember catching a garage on fire later on. It was a neighbor's garage, and I was trying to see in there. But I had no intention of burning anything like I did the first time. I was holding a match in there trying to see in there. And it fell in there. And I couldn't believe what happened. All my buddies were with me, all these peers of mine who had laughed at me the day before about my grandmother. They were with me that day, and I was trying to see what was in there. And they enjoyed the garage catching on fire. See? They really thought that was neat. And we all went up in the hill, watched the fire trucks and everything. And I was petrified with them finding me. You know, I mean, I had these thoughts in my mind that the police got some kind of method to find out who did this. And I thought, you know, they'd be concerned about who did it. And the other kids didn't think about that. They didn't seem to think until it happened. You know, I would see their dad coming, and I would say to myself, his dad's going to kill him. He's there playing and dancing around. There's my dad. But I know what he did. And I'm thinking, well, I know why his dad's coming down here. I'm glad it ain't my turn. You know, and sure enough, he'd get beat. But he didn't suffer the whole time. He didn't have his self-centeredness. He didn't seem to know. That's jackass. Didn't know he was going to get beat. You know? And so I would resent these kids that seemed to go through life without worrying about everything. And I would try to get their attention and say, look, If you realize what's going on here, you'd be worried. You know, let's get going here. I mean, there's big shit going to happen. I found other things. I found a razor blade. Razor blades are sharp, brother. They are sharp. And the best way to find that out is play with one, you know, and get a BB gun. I know why kids don't have BB guns. I know why my stepfather broke the BB gun over his knee and wanted to break it over my head. I knew why that happened before he even did it. See? Because I shot a neighbor kid with it. And the neighbor kid was making fun of me because I'm self-conscious. See? They deserved every bit of that. And I had this all going through me at all times. I did poorly in school. By the time I was eight, 9 years old, my mother remarried, and I got a stepfather that was a cross between Archie Bunker and Adolf Hitler. He made a hobby out of knocking the hell out of me, and looking back on it, I made a hobby out of deserving it. I didn't know it then, but that's what I was up to. And I had a rotten life. It was just rotten. And you know, the ones that had some kind of relationship, I didn't even know what the hell that was, so I, you know, got into like 60s and was reading everything, trying to get right. You know, and Fritz Perls and all those people from Islington and all that, we're all talking about sharing, and they did stuff like they do here with them things you pull off your time on. Tell people you love them and you hug them and you touch and get in touch with things. Jesus, I couldn't understand none of that. You know, the only time I felt good when I was drunk. When I was drunk, I said, now that's all right. Now you could do awful things. You didn't have to love me then. Kick me. I said, hey, okay, you know. Because, I mean, to me, that was reality, and it wasn't reality. And when I searched, I was searching for that, whatever the hell it was. I don't know. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I was so cynical, and so, I was afraid. I was afraid of everybody in AA because I knew something about the fifth step when I was drinking. I mean, I told people outright lies about myself that were really worse than I really was, so I could get them to confess to things. I knew about sharing, you know. And I knew there was tapes in there. I knew I had I'm okay, you're not okay tapes, you know. And, you know, and I knew Maxwell Maltz's psycho-cybernetics. I knew what Aristotle and Socrates said about it. I knew that if you really wanted to get in touch with somebody that was in reality, you'd read something by the Marquis de Sade. Or, you know, it makes you feel like you're not all that bad, you know. I mean, hell, I never put nobody on a spit and turn them around, you know. And then you have Machiavelli, if you want to get into politics and things like that. Boy, they could do more than raise your taxes, you know. And so I thought, well, they're no good neither. The cops, the politicians, the neighbors, the women, the guys I work with, industry, unions, nobody's good. And boy, I was a real joy to be around, you know. But I ended up when I'm in grade school, and I don't like what they teach me. They're teaching me the capital of Indiana, and that I want to know why you can't stick a cat's tail in a light socket. These are the kind of things. I want to know some of the... I wasn't Catholic, but I had this burning question, do patent leather shoes really reflect up? And that was bothering me, and it was years later till somebody wrote a book on it, but this was a problem for me when I was 12 years old, you know. And it seemed like a long time before the girls, you know, could get as nasty as that. Well, they were nasty, but before they were bent towards mutual nastiness. It just takes so damn long, you know. And I thought there was some, God had screwed up there somehow. He didn't have everything going the right way. I don't know. But, I went to Sunday school and learned things there that I didn't agree with and I didn't like. And I seemed to be so emotional. I remember one traumatic experience I had. They showed the king or something. I was in a Methodist church as a little boy. And I seemed to be the only one who listened. You know, everybody else was throwing spitballs at each other and doing stuff. And I'm listening to all these sermons and the Sunday school teacher and that. And I seemed to get damaged by it. I mean, they showed the greatest story ever told or whatever in a little grainy black and white movie one time they had. And I was a little kid and I got all upset about that. You know, and the tail end of the Second World War, I guess, or Korea, I don't know what was going on then, but I don't forget how old I was, but I was just a child. But they're taking Jesus down there with the cross, dragging a cross, and they're poking him and messing with him. And they already got me loving Jesus because they told me how wonderful he is. And, you know, he loves little kids and little children to him belong. They are weak and he's strong and all that. And I had all this in my mind. And now they're torturing him on the way to the cross. And I'm in the middle of this, I'm telling them, if the United States Marines were there, you know. And I remember all, you know, the adults, isn't that cute? And the other kids are just roaring with laughter at me, and I'm end up there with my back to the wall, want to fight everybody in Sunday school. Now they got this problem kid in there, they don't know what to do with me. And I didn't know why everybody was so upset and why everybody had come down on me for something that, and I'm telling myself, and I remember thinking, is this all bullshit or what? I mean, we worship Jesus and then they watch him get on the cross and somebody says they ought to stop that with a little bit of fever, a little bit of anger, and they criticize and laughed at me, and here I am, a little cynic. Little baby cynic running around, you know. So by the time I'm in, and I don't know whether this happened to everybody else. I don't know whether this causes alcoholism or does it just cause you to go around thinking you're Napoleon after a while. Or maybe you go out and cook people like Dahmer did or something. I don't know what the hell happens to you. If you get enough of that crap, something's gonna happen. But if you're like me when I was 15 years old, you find something out, see. But I won't be a damn bit of help to somebody that just drinks too much alcohol. I've been drinking too much and I've come to AA and they got me to stop. They taught me some tricks saying, brother, I don't drink and I feel good, you know. Well, that's wonderful, you know. But I am a marginal psychopath. That's my own. Now that's a plumber's diagnosis now. I'm not a medical man. And I base that on the self-improvement books I read, the life I lived, and the plumbing code of Allegheny County in Pennsylvania. This is the only thing I know anything about, you know. So there I am, stuck with this alcoholism, didn't drink yet, 15 years old, living with his stepfather who was mean to me, and I get thrown out of a nice school I went to. I went to a nice, just a nice school, regular school with boys and girls and a good football team and a nice band and just wonderful. And that was not the place for me. You know, and combined with some of the things I was helping bring rock and roll in, which was a bad thing back in 1954, I was in a little band in school. I was a drummer, and we had learned a brand new tune we heard on a black radio station, which they would only give the black radio stations about 12 watts. And so we tried to hear the good music, and they were playing that bullshit little Mickey Mouse waltz stuff on the air. And I hated it, because, you know, I mean, I like rock and roll. I like rhythm and blues. I like music, and I like the convertible. You know, and I liked the music so loud it knocked the wax flat out of your ears. And I liked when the neighbors heard it too. I didn't want just me. I wanted everybody to enjoy it. I want that car all full of friends who are also full of booze and who are full of fun and laugh and talk and speed. You know, what the hell if they wanted you to go slow? They put a brick under the gas pedal, brother. You know, as long as there's pedal, that's where you go, you know. And we used to make fun of and hear jokes about governors on cars. And what the hell is that, you know? If you got any more traffic tickets, I guess the governor's going to take it personal after a while or something. But I ended up thrown out of that school for that and selling dirty pictures and forging library. Now, this is 1954 when they run me out of there, and I was selling dirty pictures you could see on Home Box today. Matter of fact, you could see on network television. But anyhow, I ended up out of there, and they put me in Gisconley Vocational High School, which is like a black boy jungle, if you ever seen that classic movie. And that's where they put the bad boy. They put all the incorrigible, unteachable, irresponsible, nasty, dirty kids, bad ones, misfits, and dumb kids, too. They mix dumb kids in with all these. You know, and I don't know what the hell kind of mix you come up with that. I don't know if they even do that anymore, but they used to put dumb kids and nuts kids all in the same bag. And I always resented that because they left dumb kids alone. The teachers would give them something to color, and they needed them alone. Now, I always made the same kind of grades as dumb kids, but they never treated me like a dumb kid. They treated me like as if I was Einstein or something, and I'm trying to put something over on them, you know. At best, I was average. But that when you're, if you're average and you're getting bad grades, well, they make an issue, you know. And you get more attention, you're down in the office, you gotta listen to all these speeches they make, which, you know, I didn't care for, I didn't want, I didn't like, I didn't, and I hated it in there. There were some things that was going on at home my attention span was short. And I had these deficiencies and stuff I never knew You know, I didn't know anything about learning disabilities. They didn't even have them then, you know. And I'm sure if they had them, I would have, I had some, but I didn't know that. And I remember I'm sort of colorblind, and I don't know if anybody knows what colorblind, you can't explain what colorblind is. You know, you can't say, well, that's red. You say it's red, that's red, brother, because you said it. You say, I tricked him, it's blue, you know. And, you know, you got to watch what they do, you know. If you say, that's right, that's red, okay. You know, and I would know, that's red. And I could tell by shape, you know, red lights, they put the red on the top, you know, and the yellow in the middle and the green on the bottom, you know. So that's how you know. And so you could pass driver tests and everything without it. But I remember one time getting slapped around school for making the sky purple. When I was in that purple, to a guy like me, looks like blue. I can't tell the difference unless you hand me two, and then I can see the shades. I see that one that's a little lighter. That's the blue one that they said, you know, so I'll know. But, I mean, I made a sky purple, and I got slapped. So I thought, what the hell's the matter here, you know? And I thought, well, why can't I remember which one's which? Well, I couldn't remember it because I couldn't distinguish it. You know, looking back on it, I had some kind of a problem there. But anyhow, I'm a mess in school, and I don't like it, and this stepfather got me scared all the time. And so I ended up in Conley. And I'm down there not doing well at all, except I got a guy in a print shop. I was in a plumbing shop, and this printing shop had a guy who made report cards. And so with the report cards, I put the grades that I thought would walk with the old man, you know. I mean, I wasn't stupid enough to put A's on there, you know. I was streetwise. So I put whatever he would, you know, he'd complain about one subject coming down, I'd bump it up a half a point, you know. I just wanted to keep them grades so he wouldn't beat me. That's all. I wasn't worried about what they were. It was, in, you know, unimportant. But I had a bad report card come out once again, and that kid wasn't in. He was in juvenile court or something, and I couldn't get another card. And I had somebody after meeting. I told that story. They said, well, why didn't you store them cards? You can't store cards. They have locker searches. You got to know that if you're slick. You can't be putting blank report cards. If they say, oh, what are the blank report cards for? Oh, I take notes on them. You know, you don't store them. You get them like today, day at a time. That's how you do. And so I didn't have any. And I was scared to death. And I went home. I tried to fix the original. And I ruined it. And now I, you know, I was falsifying records now. I was doing everything. And I was already in trouble. I had some horrendous thing I had done already. I left his favorite paintbrush get hard or some other bullshit. Left his good wrench out, you know, something, you know. And I knew that this time here with the bad report card combined with this other infraction or two that I had, this was going to be a capital crime. There was no question about it. And I'm pacing the house. I'm 15 years old. And my mother's just, get away from me, because she couldn't handle it. Because every time I would do what I was told not to do or something like that, I would get the thing going. And the old man would be like, he acted like an alcoholic. You wouldn't believe it. He'd get drunk, and he'd bust up furniture, and he'd bust up me. And it was like as if he was an alcoholic. And I'd be so terrified of that. And my mother was so terrified of, and I would stir it up accidentally because I would do the wrong thing. I would try to escape and stuff like crawl out a window to get out of the house before he'd come home, and I'd fall, break something, you know, knock the rain conductor off. Now I either got to fix it myself, but he'll find it later because he could tell which way the head was turned on a screw that you did it yourself. You know, it just seemed like he just was unbelievable for catching me and what I did, you know. And I tried to get, you know, one time I got him so good, I could have done cartwheels. He had these these dies, they weren't ratchet, the stocking dies for thread and pipe. And he asked me to thread some pipe for him, and I broke the dies, see. I broke the carriage that they were in. And I took it to school all in pieces, and one of the kids in the machine shop made them for me out of soft steel, cold steel. And I put them in, and they fit perfect. And he gets on the next job he had, and he's turning, and it bends. He said, I'll never forget what he said. He said, this tool must have lost its temper, you know. And I had never heard that. I never heard that before. And I took it to school, and I asked the teacher down there in the plumbing shop. I said, what's it mean, a metal lose its temper? Well, he explained to me, I get too hot, too cold or something. And then it's no good no more. It's soft. And I thought, gee, I'll never forgot that. That was one of the lessons he taught me. It's just been wonderful, you know. It's helpful in my trade later, you know. But anyhow, I was waiting for him to come home, and I knew he was going to kill me. And I found sloe gin in the icebox. That's that red stuff that tastes like Hawaiian punch, you know. And I drank it. I don't know how much was in there. Half a quart or a fifth or whatever they come in. Or I drank it. Now, I'm here to tell you what happened to me. I didn't find an answer. I found the answer. Everything that I've been whining and crying about now for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, went away. And I used to get so upset with regular people who couldn't understand that. I was so impatient and so angry. People would say, why do you drink? Let me tell you, you know. I feel like sticking a pistol in my nose when I'm not drinking, and I feel good when I'm drinking. Now, what the hell can't you understand about that? What part, you know? So the thing wasn't about why I drank. The thing was about how am I going to drink and get away with it? How am I going to drink and control it enough so that I can slide through life somehow with a minimum amount of, you know, damage control? You know, just put a lid on whatever happens. Well, to compound my own crap, I got married when I was 17 years old. I married the best girl I could have ever found, and she's here with me. And that was the worst girl I could have married, you know, because she was the enemy. She personified everybody that I couldn't get along with. I mean, she was, like, good and sensible and considerate and responsible. And every little mannerism about people that I hated, she had. She raised her eyebrows at the wrong time. She would be shocked at what I did when I thought it was funny. I'd come in the house and say, you wouldn't believe what I did to this guy. And I would tell her, and she'd say, oh, my God. You know, I met them alcoholic women out there. I wanted one of them kind of women that I could have DTs with. You know? But you couldn't. They were no good because they were as nuts as me, and Christ, you can't live with one of them. But you know what they're going to do. I mean, they'll just do crazy shit. I remember a strange one I wasn't even talking to in a bar. Come over and took my car keys, didn't even know me, and went out and threw them in a sewer. And then I thought, why'd she do that? And I said, hey, why'd you do that? Screw you, she said. Now, my wife did a lot of things to me. When I was drunk, she beat me with a dust mop when I was sleeping. But that made sense. That wasn't... My wife would have never took the car keys and threw them in a sewer. You know? Just don't do things like that. You got a problem, you deal with the problem. You don't have this misplaced aggression and stuff like that. That I got accused of things like that from all the numerous authorities that I kept bumping heads with as time went on. And I tried, you know, God help me, I tried to read. I'm a plumber, and I'm trying to read enough books on psychology and social psychology, anthropology, things like that, so that I could get some kind of edge on them sons of bitches that always got me. You know, and I could never read enough, and I couldn't stay sober long enough to read enough to get them, you know. And my wife was trying to help me the whole time. It was unbelievable. My wife... Well, what I considered help wasn't what she was doing. But, I mean, she was trying to get me straight. She was trying to get me to be a father, a husband, a neighbor, an employee. She was trying to get me to do the things that would make for some kind of life, you know. And I didn't see it that way because that was like side things to me. I thought if I ever get a hold of this thing that tortures me in my mind... Then I could do anything. I thought if I could get a hold of that, then I could be all the crap you want me to be. Want me a good father? I could be the greatest father you ever seen, make you puke. You know? But I couldn't want to do it. I wanted to do it for a minute, but then, you know, it got like, meh, I want this, I want that, and there's kids and they're snotting. And I wanted my wife to go with me down them clubs, you know, and I didn't see them clubs the way she's seen them. I see him now the way she's seen him. You know, open the door, smoke rolls out of the damn place. There's cars parked sideways down there, old rattle traps. Parked too close to my nice new car, you know. And so, you know, in the end days, I didn't give a damn. I just bought a car, get out of it, and slam a door on somebody else. I hit that sumbitch. Look at that. You know, I don't worry about mine. You know, I'm, hell, that's all right, because I'm drinking. And when I see my car just sort of die in front of me, like as months went on, I think, Christ, I just bought that car, seems to me, like 6 months ago. I'd pay, in those days, you know, it was a long time ago, I'd pay maybe $1,500 for a couple-year-old car. And I had this one convertible. I bought a 61 Plymouth Fury convertible in 64, you know, and I when I got rid of it about a year and a half later, it was worth $50. And the dealership told me it wasn't worth anything. But the guy said, I got a guy needs his car, needs what they call him, a flapper or something, a beater. That's what he is. This is a beater. And he said, I got a guy's looking for a beater. And I want to kill a guy for saying that because, see, I'm sort of a hip guy, and I hadn't, up until that time, I had never been told what a beater was, but when he called my car a beater, I knew what that meant. You know? And I thought to myself, you know, that's a pretty good name for that piece of shit. And later on, you know, I got to selling cars later on, and I, you know, I mean, I knew that stuff. I knew which was what, you know, and, oh, it was awful. And, I couldn't combat anything, and my wife was trying to fix me, and I got these kids now. Well, towards the end of my drinking, I had two by that time. I had one, when I come in AA, I had one 13-year-old daughter, and I had a, 3-year-old little girl. And the 3-year-old little girl, I didn't get the chance to damage her, but I'd done a pretty much damage 13-year-old. And my wife and I both were doing our best to make the most nuts family we could ever have. So, as a matter of fact, I remember coming out this way. My parents moved out to, in 1961. They moved to Chicago, and I stayed there in Pittsburgh, which didn't seem to bother them much. And, But I'd come out to visit them occasionally, and I just raised hell in Chicago, and I'd get in trouble. It was a fun place to drink. I mean, booze was real cheap, and I come back from there, and Christ, I forget what I was talking about. All that other stories just leaped in my mind that I brought booze back to Pennsylvania. Whiskey was twice as much in PA as it was here. And I had an open pickup truck, and I bought several cases of whiskey, and I had them in the back, and I got to Angola, Indiana. I was right on the border there of Ohio, and the truck blew up, and I got this whiskey in the back with a tarp over it, and I got two sets of state police at the truck. It was right in that no man's land between the two states there, and both Ohio and Indiana police were like walking around my truck, and I got that whiskey in there. My wife is saying, "You bought that whiskey? You had to buy that goddamn whiskey." So they decided that where I should go. You know, they didn't know where to have me towed. So they had me towed to Angola, Indiana. And we got in one of these hotels. There was an old hotel there that had swastikas on the floor. I couldn't believe it. Well, they were like backwards swastikas. The guy told me it was some kind of Indian sign or something. And I didn't believe that. I thought they were swastikas. But I was staying at a hotel with her. We were in one room and she hated me by this time. And all I had was my cases of whiskey and I felt like I would sit on the middle of these whiskey bottles and drink them, you know. And then she would argue with me, and I would get up and take a few under my jacket, and I would go down around the town and try to sell these things. And if you try to just sell whiskey like that in another state, it just gets everybody tuned up, you know. And I was drunk enough that I didn't care, you know. And I sold a few bottles and got a little bit of cash, and my wife wired home for money, and I got some guy to fix my truck. We went home on a wing and a prayer, and the clutch was activating about a quarter inch off the floor of that thing. My wife was telling me all the way home how she'll never go anywhere ever with me ever again. And if she didn't kill me in one of them broken whiskey bottles, something the car was going to kill me, or God would get me or something. And we had our little daughter with us. But I had so much trouble raising kids. You know, I was like, no, you can't do it if you're not home, for one thing. When I was home, they were in my way. My wife would, like, I'll tell you a for instance about how I operated normally. I got paid on Thursdays, and I got drunk on payday. I was a blue-collar problem drinker, and if you are and you don't get drunk on payday, there's something wrong with your alcoholism. That's just what you do. You get drunk payday. Try and get it right, you know. And so I'd get drunk payday, and that was Thursday and Friday. And you'd go out to the roadhouses and boogie and dance and get drunk some more. And Saturday, why, I'd just get drunk all day. I wasn't working the weekend. I'd just get drunk. And so I'd wake up, and I'd go get drunk, and then I'd get sober, and I'd get drunk again. And you need money to do that, so you got to do things nobody seems to like. You sell punch boards and write numbers and football pools and get them mixed and forget to turn them in and get hits and go to your higher power, which is places like Beneficial Finance Company, and get money and pay this and don't pay that and skip this and phones jumping off the hook and borrow money off friends and don't give it back and just do stuff that ain't right, you know. And I remember I didn't have a plumbing license in them days, and I had plumbing inspector chasing me all over the place, and I'd tell him to go to hell, and he'd tell me, you're going to jail. And I'd say, at least I have a place to sleep. I don't give a shit. And I was just like crazy, you know, and I burned a lot of bridges, and I got in a lot of trouble, and I made my wife's life miserable. And like I say, I tried to read myself out of that thing. But I'd wake up on a Sunday, typically, after that kind of a weekend, drunk for 4 days or so. And my wife would wake me up with a dust mop. She'd stick it in me and push it. And I'd get out of the bed, and she'd say, all right, let's go. And I'd say, where are we going? She'd say, you promised to take us to the zoo. Oh, no. No, no. And I'm sitting on the side of the bed by this time with absolutely blind with this headache, just blind with the hangover. And I could feel that green bile coming up. And I'll tell you something I learned then that I carried with me, and maybe you could do it if you want to go out and drink. You don't have to throw up. Just don't throw up. Just don't do it. I found out how to not do that. You just don't throw up. It starts coming up, just don't do it. Just the opposite of AA, you don't let go. And your eyes are water, your nose is running, your ears are ringing, but by God, you don't throw up. Just stand there, just keep pushing it back down. You know? Now you learn, you know, once you learn that, then you can drink whiskey the right way. See? Now you can do some drinking and watch some other people fall down walking around on their knees, and you can stand there like a man in front of the pinball machine, you know. And just be Mr. Goodbar, you know, you're just all right, you know. And my God, and my wife would just say, we got to go to the zoo. I knew by Sunday it was not my turn. Sunday was her turn. And my daughter would be over in the corner crying. And I was so cynical by this time, I figured my wife's taking an eyedropper and put fake tears in my daughter's eyes. My daughter couldn't possibly cry at so convenient a time to pacify my wife's anger and all that. I didn't know how it could possibly be that way. It seemed to me like every time I really needed to get drunk, it was just automatically my daughter's birthday. Again! She was like 7 years old 150 times in 1 year. It just seemed that way. I don't know if it, you know, naturally it wasn't, but I mean, just, to me it just seems like, oh, you would get drunk. Your mother called, you know. Your boss called, you know. I got drunk because I wasn't getting no overtime. As soon as I got drunk, the heat boss called my wife and said, can he come in? You know, it's just like, and I come home drunk. I said, I don't get no overtime. That's why I got drunk. She said, well, he called while you were gone. You know? And then maybe I'd be stupid enough and drunk enough to call him up drunk and give him hell for not getting to me somehow. Why don't you call every bar in Pittsburgh? You know? Hell, I'd have come in. You really need me in there walking around on my knees. That'd be nice. You know, hopefully customers would run into me and I could help them. You know? But it's just everything I touched was bad, and I was sick all the time, and I was all the things that I didn't want to be, but I knew on account of my earlier deductions that there was nothing better for me. See, I knew something that wasn't true. Isn't that something? That you know, you absolutely know something that's wrong. Boy, that's a humbling experience. When you come in AA, if you come in like I did, they just, oh, they killed me in here. Well, I ended up here. And I thought that was the worst thing that could possibly happen to anyone. To come here. How could I come here? I mean, how can you come AA and you're hip? You know, you want things that are important. You know, I wanted to sleep with my wife more. You know, and I wanted to dance boogie, and I liked funky jazz, and I wanted to hear more of it. And I wanted a better stereo and a faster car, and I want a convertible that put its own tarp on the back. You know, I never did button one of them down. I remember pulling out with the top going down as I was pulling out. And I had it all bent with the wind, you know. But I had a hell of a time putting that thing back. But I wanted. You know, I remember reading something that Bill Wilson wrote. He wants you screaming out a window, I want, and hollering at New York City, I want. He didn't know what the hell he wanted. I want. And that's what I wanted. And I was so just disgusted with life and afraid to kill myself, knew that this stuff was going to kill me. If it didn't, all the rest of the side effects and other things that I was doing simultaneously. See, I was like a flypaper for any kind of problems and picking up vices and everything attached to me, like I was flypaper inside of a chicken coop or something. I brought people home. You know, I would bring people home. I remember one time I thought, my wife ain't going to find nothing else in this car. She was like Sherlock Holmes. She'd get in that car and find something through deduction. She could figure out where I was, what I'd done, who I was with. She just would know. It was like there was CIA reports coming in all the time. And she would just know. And she was wrong occasionally, but I didn't even know when she was wrong. Because I would think the worst of myself. I would get so, you know, and I was no Don Juan out there, but there's little else to do, you know. And my wife would, you know, my wife was on the borderline of killing me every night. You don't get a lot of romance from somebody like that, you know. And not only that, but when I did come on to her, she would cry. And, you know, that's, even a 50s kind of guy has a little compassion, you know, for a woman that's crying and say, well, all right, you know. I can see what's not going to happen tonight, you know. God, how can a man live with himself? It's doing these things, but you can't. I was a young man in my late 20s, and that when the worst of it was going on, and I had desires, you know, and that it would come and go, like sort of being in some kind of a pneumonia, fever coming in hot, you know, and you just think you. And I remember flirting with women in bars. I remember laying a heavy rap on one of them, and it looked like she was believing it, and then I puked. That was one of the times it just like snuck up on me. I had no chance to control it. You know? And she made the same face at me my wife made at me. Oh, you know. So much for that. You know. I had to go to psychiatry. My wife drugged clergy home. I got in arguments with them. I'd win the arguments. Send them packing. And they'd leave, and on the way out, they'd say to her, I'm sorry, Mrs. Dempsey. I could never figure out what they were sorry about. See, I had this alcoholic mind, and I thought different than you're supposed to think. And I knew that, too. That tortured me, that I knew it. And I could never quite get it right on how they thought, whoever they are. I'd say, I'm going to think just like them. This is, you know. And I'd try to think like them, and I wouldn't think like them. It would turn out, no, I wasn't thinking. I thought I was, but I wasn't even thinking like me. So I was thinking like some kind of a madman, you know. I remember, finally, they get me to go to a psychiatrist. Can you imagine that? I go to a psychiatrist, and I know what I want from him before I go in there, see? It's because I have this alcoholic mind. So I have to make a decision what I'm going to give him, so what he's going to give me. I mean, look at it this way. Look at it alcoholically. If I tell him everything I've done, much less everything I thought, then he's probably going to be legally compelled to have me gassed. You know, it's probably going to be some kind of a civic responsibility. Now, if I tell him just, oh, I've done this, I've done a little bit of this, and maybe one time, by God, I stepped out on the missus. You know, if I tell him something, he'll say, well, don't do that anymore, and get a hobby, and come back next week, and that'll be $100. You know? So I already knew the answers I was going to get. What I did was I made a little case up of the truth. I thought, well, he ain't going to give me Mickey Mouse help if I don't tell him something. If I tell him the truth, then he's going to gas me. So I got to tell him something in the middle so he'll help me a little bit so that maybe I could get out from under this problem I have, see? So I give him like a mediocre story, you know, of truth. I took truth here, a little truth. Give me some of that. And I put some of the truth together to give him a package of a fellow that was a little disturbed and depressed a lot and not getting along well, you know. And I thought, well, he'll fix me, you know. He gets this, and the evaluation is, knocks me out of my socks. I mean, he's telling me like a possibility of being suicidal, homicidal. I got these latent something or other. I don't know what the hell it is. And I find out after I get sober that I'm if I drink, I'm latent everything. You know, I can't imagine anything I wouldn't do drunk. It scares the hell out of me. Think of it. Because I won't do it for the right reasons. You know, I mean, I wouldn't indicate that there's any kind of problem with me going kissing another man, you know. But I surely wouldn't do it for the right reasons. You know, I mean, I wouldn't do it because I just loved him. Because I don't. I don't like men. They're furry. And they're hard and rough. And I don't like them. So what in the hell would I want to kiss one for? But I would kiss one if somebody said, I'll give you $50 a good drinking money if you kiss that ugly sumbitch. So I would kiss him, you know. And if somebody offered me more money or said, look, I'm going to kill you if you don't just make love with this guy. You're on. You know, so I would do absolutely anything. And I'm not trying to indicate that homosexuality is bad. Everything's bad. For me, I was leading a meeting one time, and I told them how I went to a nudist camp one time when I was drinking, so because I wanted to see bare ladies. That's why I went in there. And they wouldn't let me see none. So I said, how can I see some of them? They said, well, you can't go around the ground, sir, unless you're going to become a member here. And I said, well, that's good. I want to become a member. Give me the. And they said, oh, well, you know, we have two programs. We have a family program and we have an individual program, you know. And I thought, well, I'll have to join the family plan because he ain't going to let me look otherwise. He'll think I'm a lech, you know. I don't want the guy to think I'm lecherous. So I said, I'll go on a family program. And he gave me forms then. He wouldn't let me in. He just gave me forms. So I brought the forms home. And I was drunk, and I put the forms on the table. And my wife says, what's this? I said, by that time, I forgot what they were. I said, just sign that stuff. I think I had in the back of my mind it was from Beneficial Finance, you know, papers. But my wife stayed up all night about them. She didn't want to sign them because she was trying to get my daughter not to take her clothes off. You know? And so now the old boy, the drunk, comes home with this kind of crap. But anyhow, it was like a big to-do, and it was a big trauma-filled time in our marriage. And all I wanted to do was go in there and look, you know. But anyhow, I told this story at an AA meeting one time, and after the meeting, somebody came up to me and said, well, I got sober in AA, and I was sober 3 years and had to work all them steps and get all right before I had the courage to join the American Sunbathing Association. I thought, you know, I mean, who am I to judge? You know, I look around and there's people doing things. I see people on Oprah that are demanding the right to do things that I got sober because I was doing them things. You know? So, it seems to me there's only two ways. I'm not trying to preach or tell anybody, well, don't do any of that stuff. But my God, it makes life spicy for an old guffer like me. I said, God damn, you see what they're doing now, you know. And you know, I mean, they thought they had a handle in the 60s. They thought they do some stuff today, I'm telling you. And that's great, as long as my grandkids don't do it, you know. Worry, it makes me nervous, but I don't think about it a lot because AA taught me how to think. So for the most part, I'm thinking what I'm supposed to think. And every once in a while, I get diversions and I think my own thoughts that I'm going to fix something or help, or I want to do things like be part of the solution. And I don't even know what the problem is. I mean, I got my ideas of what, there's a problem, there's one, we all seem going, there's problems going around here. And you'll have people that agree with you. Boy, that's a problem, Jack, look over there. You know, and now that's no problem to me anymore. I remember I had a problem some years ago with young people coming in AA that should have been in AA. You know, and they're coming in AA, and I was one of the guys that disturbed a lot. Well, I got mad because the young people were coming in my home group, and they were, you know, they were just doing stuff. You know, they were parking in the fire lane, and they were tearing the urinals off the walls, and they were making love up in the pulpit and that upstairs in the church. And mostly what bothered me was the clergy in the church was mad at me. And I was mad because I wasn't fornicating up there. You know? And I wouldn't do it. Why the hell would I do that? You know, I mean, that's, you get in trouble. As you get older, you know, it, some things it don't pay to do, you know. I mean, that's the one lesson you get from getting older. You just get it, boom, that's no good. And you do it again, boom, again. What do you say? Man, I ain't doing that no more. Somebody say, ah, come on. You know, all right, just this once. Boom, it happens. You know, and if this has been going on since you're 13, 14 years old, you catch on some of them, you know. You know. Now, if you get to be a 55-year-old bald-headed fat guy, finally some things are coming through, you know. And so this is what's happened to me. For the most part, this is what my recovery is based on. You know, Pavlov's law, you know. It's this hurts, don't do it. That hurts, don't do it. Like, I got off cigarettes a while ago, about 4 months ago, and I did that the way I seen that guy that was in the Grumpy Old Men did. He I just coughed, and you cough and the lungs like come up, you push them back down. You say maybe that'll be the last of them, somebody. I mean, I recommend smoke as long as you can. And I recommend you use everything up. Use it up, you know what I mean? Read until you can't see anymore, till your glasses are that thick. Because it's good to read and get it all in so you can remember to read and remember the making love and remember the working hard and that when you're young. And I remember those things, and I'm proud about those things. And I'm glad I did. We have an old guy up our way that says that he's not the kind of guy that wishes he never drank. He said that's the best thing. He's rather have drank and lost than never drank at all, you know. Listen, I'm so pleased that's I got that behind me, but damn it, it was the way to go. I mean, with my thinking, the way I was, that was the only way I could go. I took a chance on running my own life, and I screwed it up. But by damn, I tried, you know. And it wasn't for me not really getting in there, mixing it up, you know. And I have to be happy about it. Either got to be happy or unhappy, you know. And they give you that. That's the only choices you get in AA. But with all the feelings I had about them young people in those days, when it happened, God jumps in again. I got a daughter, she's married to a guy, got a drug problem. He goes to NA. And he goes to NA, and he calls me on the phone. He has a lot of respect for me, and he's good to me, and I love that young man. And his sponsor, he got a sponsor right away, and he come down to Hasse, he wanted to talk to me about him going into NA. And I heard him out, and then he called me the next night. He said, his sponsor can't be there, and he's afraid to go up this NA meeting by himself. He said, would you go with me? I said, yeah, you know, I'll go. So I go to an NA meeting. And when I get in there, all these young people who are in the NA meeting know me from AA. So I got these alcoholic thoughts. They're going to think I'm secretly flipping Valium down or something. You know? But anybody that really knew me knew if I had a drug problem, it wasn't a downer, you know, that I was, it wasn't Librium or Valium or Thorazine, nothing like that, you know. And I went, and then I thought, darn, I mean, I thought, I want them to know I'm not taking speed or smoking grass or nothing, you know. But I couldn't be like that at a meeting, you know. I want them to think I was already sober, what, 18 years or something at that time. And hell, I didn't want to act up. So it goes around a meeting. Everybody knows me. Hey, Jack, good to see you, you know. They were so nice to me, and they knew I was a grouchy old bastard, but maybe you ought to go to NA type guy I was, you know what I mean? And there I am, right in the middle of this shit, and they're being so nice to me, it was just killing me. And it goes all around the room, and it gets to me. And I had to tell my name, I said, my name's Jack. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. I said, but I'm here as I brought my son-in-law here tonight, you know, and I'm sort of like a guest here, you know. And they all laughed, you know, and it broke the ice, and I felt better about it, you know. And the little bit of tightness that I was trying to hang on to try to be something that I didn't need to be. See, because I'm inclined to forget that I am, you know. And I don't care how old you are, I think it slips up on you. It gets up there where you want to be something, you know. Guys have joked with me about, you know, was all I remember the things I used to get trapped into. Like, I remember when that old plumbing inspector used to chase me. And then when AA got me to go get all my credentials, you know, I'd say, somebody say, what do you do? I said, I'm a plumber. And my sponsor is somebody who knew I didn't have my license. Would say, no, you're not. And So then they don't ask me, and they just ask you flat out, what do you need to do to get to be a plumber? Well, all I got to do is do that, and this and it's all a big deal, and I got to go back to school, and I'm 48 years old at the time. And they said, well, do it. When do you sign up? You know. And so I did all them things. I go in there, I'm 48 years old, I'm down at school. All them guys down there are 18, 19 years old. And I damn near quit 10 times. My job where I worked, I was a pipe fitter plumber for Westinghouse, and they closed that plant, and I ended up have to go back. I had to, you know, I had to start business, and so I knew it was coming, so I went back to school. About the last time I was really going to hang it up, I had one teacher, I didn't like him, and he would patronize me in that, and he was about 15, 20 years my junior, and I didn't like him, and it was getting tough, and I was going to quit. Hell, catch a little bit of checks here and there, get a job as a night watchman and just wither away or something. And a guy that I had seen in AA meetings see me on the street coming out of near the last week or so of my job I had at that plant. And he says, hey, you going back to plumbing school? I know you missed last semester. I said, nah, I was thinking about not going. He said, why not? I said, well, that teacher, I didn't get along with it. Fourth year teacher down there, and I thought, how the hell would it? He said, well, you better come back this semester. I said, well, why? He said, well, that guy's not teaching there no more. I said, well, that's good. I said, who's teaching there? He says, I am. I said, got an AA teacher down there. Shit. I said, okay, man, I'll be back. He said, good. So I went back to school. I got an AA guy, you know, teaching me the last semester. Got my license. I got a job with a plumber to get my last year apprentice, a five-year apprenticeship. So I got a job with a plumber, and I had to take half the money I was making at the Westinghouse. And I had all the responsibility. They had a radio in the truck to make sure you didn't miss 1 minute without working. You finish your job, and it seemed like you'd be finished the job. You get in the truck, grab hold of the handle, open the door. Radio says, Jack, come in. Well, this is the office. We got another job. Where are you at? And I'd tell them, and it'd be another job. And, oh, man, it was like my back was hurting. My hind end was sore. Feet hurt. And I'm getting half the money, and I'm disgusted, and I needed that year, and I got that year in, and it was ready for me to take my, I already had my journeyman's test passed, and now I'm going to take my master's test, and man, it's going to be great, and I'm quitting, start my own business, and I the last day of work, got my last hour, and got that boss to verify my time, and I quit, left. Next night, I took the plumbing test, and flunked. And then I had to go back. I had my journeyman's license, but I had, you know, I knew I had to take that test, and I had to wait 6 months to test it. Now I don't have no job, and so I, and I'm not allowed to do work. See, you're not allowed without the license. And I thought, well, I'll do it anyhow. No, you'll get caught. You'll have a plumbing inspector again up your tube, and you're here. You are sober and nice now, and doing things right. And I was just like frosted. And I got AA meetings, and they would just tell me, well, go back to school. Don't waste the 6 months. Go back, take another, go through it again. Go to the fourth year class and hang out in there and pay more attention this time and get relaxed. Do whatever you have to do. So I did. I went back. Nobody ever did that before, apparently. They flunked. They went back to school. They flunked. They just hide in the corner, I guess, everybody, and read the book more. And then go in and take it again. Not me. I went back to school. On account of the AAs made me go back to school. I was embarrassed, too. I walked in there with a stupid-looking grin on my face. And they all said, what are you doing here? I said, flunk. I said, get out. You know, that scared them all. We might flunk, too. And you hear them buzzing, you know. And I could, like, almost sense they were saying things like, I thought he was pretty bright, you know. And second time around, I passed it. You know, I mean, they didn't have a band come out of Pittsburgh and say, boy, the highest grades we ever had, but I passed it. And my wife bought me a truck, and my wife became my boss, and you'd think I'd live happily ever after, you know. I got a little business, and I'm allowed to talk about it here because, you know, if I talked about it at home, well, I'd be like using AA to advertise your business. But I just hope nobody calls me in Indiana to ask for a water heater, you know. But it's nice to be able to talk about what you do at a meeting. That's what's nice about, one of the things nice about going away from home, because, you know, you can talk about something like that. And I don't have any guilt about talking about my job here because there's nothing going to help me here. You know, matter of fact, I don't want big time stuff, you know. I can't handle it, for one thing. I'd get real nuts, and my wife would holler at me, and I'd cry, and it'd be the end of it, you know. My wife spent a lot of time before Al-Anon and in Al-Anon not wanting to know about where I was and what I was doing, because she'd done that for years, and she got in Al-Anon, and they hollered at her, don't worry about him, worry about yourself. So she detached from all my stuff. Now I got my own business. Now she has to know where I'm at, where I'm going. She has to know the phone number. She has to call me. She has to schedule everything. And she's just up to here with me most of the time now, you know. And that's all right. And I got my little beeper. And she beeps, and she's so civil with me. It's just wonderful. You know, Jack, I have a job for you, and it's in, you know, she's business-like. And I like it like that, you know. No screaming and hollering. Don't do no use, you know, because I'm over in Penn Hills, and she's up in Holiday Park. And I've done a lot of things to get sober in here that they made me do. There's a lot of stuff I wanted to talk about. It's getting late. I'm not going to talk about it. Once one of the speakers said today, we'll talk more about the recovery. But, I don't think I have to say too much about the recovery. I think that once in a while I should. I think that anybody that comes to AA is going to hear it. If you don't hear it, maybe I wasn't supposed to say it. Maybe that's not the best thing I have to say. I've got recovered enough to stay sober. I've stayed sober a long time through the help of God, my sponsor, my family, Alcoholics Anonymous mostly. I had to do them things. And I'd like to convey to you that I think you have to, too. I think if you want to get sober, you got to do what we do here. You might do it a little different, might do it faster, slower, but it seems to me it's got to be done. I think if I have any messages to give you here tonight, it's one that was the most important message that I got when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first came in here, I heard people get up at this podium and say they were grateful for being sober. And I couldn't understand what that meant, you see. Now, if you're sitting out here tonight and you don't understand when I tell you that I'm grateful for being sober, and I am grateful for being sober. If you're as cynical and as bad as I was when I first came in, you think that can't be. Because you were the kind of person that I was when I was new, in that I was not drinking when I was at the AA meetings, but I wasn't sober. I wasn't sober in the fact that I didn't like to be not drinking. I was just not drinking. Can't you see I'm not drinking? You know? What else do you want from me? You know? And that's the attitude I had when I was in here, when I'd hear these birds get up there and saying, I'm so grateful to be sober. You know? And they'd say, give figures out, like my figure, 23 years! I thought, you poor son of a bitch. That was the, you know, and I couldn't imagine how anyone could possibly be grateful for being sober. You see? And something happens in here, well, lots of things happen. But that's the message I think that a person like me should give to a new person. The message is that if you come here and you do what we do, you end up through your brain cells turned to soot or something, you believe you're grateful for being sober. When you actually get up and say, hey, I'm sober! And you feel good. Now, other people might say, whoa, boy, there's something wrong with him, man. You know, he's a pickle or two short of a sandwich. But it don't matter what they say. It does not. It never did matter, right? I mean, I would get out in the middle of the street and say, I don't care what you say. I tell my neighbors, go ahead, turn your lights now and go to bed. Because I'm home now, and you're no chance now of me running over your mailbox. You're going to be all right. With your precious little flower garden and everything. So I'm not going to hurt you now. Go to bed. Now, that was my attitude about them. And if I had that attitude, why in the hell would I be worried about what somebody says now about me, you know? It just doesn't matter, like that Murray said in that movie about the camp, you know? It just doesn't matter, you know? And I'm grateful to be here tonight. And I hope I didn't do any damage, you know? I think a lot of alcoholics that talk at these meetings ought to have to take a Hippocratic oath or something. Just do no harm, you know? And I'm sure I offended some people. I'm sure there's people in here, and I'm not, you know, I'm not the pinnacle of anything, except the pinnacle of an example that a real fruitcake can come in here with a gigantic alcohol problem and get over it. Not so much get over it, but get so he can put a whole bunch of time together without doing any more real damage outside of himself as far as being a jerk's concerned. But I, you know, every one of us are human. And I'm really, I say a lot of these things in fun today, because I do have a certain amount of real pride. And I have a lot of stuff to do with myself. I think all the things, all the superficial things about me, you can well understand. The cat's out of the bag now for the American culture as far as where we're at. And you know you shouldn't be fat. You shouldn't smoke. You shouldn't be vulgar. You shouldn't a lot of things. And if you are, if it was so easy to not be those things, then every nice person would certainly be them, you know. And I wish I could do that. Here I am, 55 years old, and I just recently quit smoking. Can you imagine that? And can you imagine going to Alcoholics Anonymous for over 23 years? It'll be 24 years before this month's over. You gotta really, there gotta be something to motivate somebody to do that. Just think about it. You know, I've been going to 3-4 meetings a week for almost 24 years. You don't do that because, it's a nice place to belong, like the Elks or something, you know? And you gotta, if you're like me, you got a concerted effort going to try to make something out of your life, to try to become, to get a hold of your soul. You know, I come here to be something that I think God wants me to be. And I'm being it as fast as I can, with as much vigor as I have. You know, and I've seen a lot of loves come my way in here. My family, my kids, my friends, I've seen so much love. And I've been indulged with my anger and my temper and my jealousy and my arrogance and all that has been indulged by my... They say, go ahead, Jack, damn it. We like that part of you that makes a lot of noise and sweats and spits on the first row, you know. And people, when they learn what to do, that guy sweats and he spits on the first row, the next time they know he's talking, they sit in the second row. And they enjoy themselves laughing at the new people that come and sit in the first row, you know. Because they make the best out of everything here. And God, we can't find, there ain't nothing better for an alcoholic that has the propensity to go blow his own head off, to jump in the middle of a bunch of people that get up every day and do the damnedest they can to make the best out of that day. It's like the biggest job we got here. Everybody's working on it. And you get in here, you're like in some kind of a factory that's making things all right. God damn it, keep pushing over there. Get this thing going. Get it happy. Get it fun. Start a dance. Get a meeting going. Stay up all night and bullshit. Make up with your wife. Send a letter about amends. Do something today. They make you do it. If every time I ever confided with AAs and told them what the hell was mattered, I let that chin drop down on my chest, say, oh, good shit, man. You know, and I'd say, get your chin up. I just heard a speaker say that. You know, my chin was down on my chest, and the speaker said that sponsor would go like this, you know, put your chin up, you know. And it was a touching thing, and I heard, and you hear different things every day. And I've talked too long, and they'll edit my tape, and all the swear words will be gone. Thanks for listening to me. God bless you.